This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءَ مَسَّتْهُ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran says its talks on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal with the remaining signatories will probably not conclude in the current round. Indigenous groups in Canada called for a nationwide search for mass graves at residential school sites after the discovery of the remains of 215 children. Also, Colombian demonstrators clash with security forces as the country undergoes its second month of anti-government protests. Thank you for joining us. With our top story, Iran says the talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal aimed at reviving the accord will probably not conclude in the current round. Iran's top negotiator described the talks as complicated, adding that negotiations have reached the main issues of dispute. Abbas Araghchi noted the progress has been made at the talks, but delegations might need to return to their capitals for consultations. The current round of talks on the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA, had previously been hailed as the final round. Tehran says it will return to compliance with the accord after verifiable removal of all sanctions the U.S. has imposed on the country since pulling out of the deal in 2018. Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says the latest report by the U.N. nuclear watchdog confirms Tehran's move to limit the agency's monitoring of its nuclear work. Kazem Gharibabadi said the report shows the agency has not been able to monitor Iran's nuclear work beyond its safeguards agreement with Tehran under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Gharibabadi added that the IAEA's report on Iran's enriched uranium stockpile is merely based on an assessment. Iran's decision to limit the agency's monitoring activities followed a December parliamentary law that asked the government to withdraw from the additional protocol and scale back nuclear-related commitments. That is in response to the U.S. pullout of the 2015 nuclear deal and its anti-Iran sanctions. The IAEA report has estimated that Tehran's enriched uranium stockpile is around 16 times the limit laid out in the nuclear deal. Homa Lizki says the latest IAEA report to its Board of Governors shows the impact of the agency's complementary access to Iranian nuclear sites being restricted. Here's more.
The Iranian ambassador to the agency, Mr. Kazem Gharibabadi, and he said that the information given in this report, first of all, you mentioned that the stockpile of Iran's enriched uranium, based on the media reports we're getting, the number being mentioned around 3,241 kilograms, which of course is way more than the limit that was set in the JCPOA, is according to Iran and also acknowledged by the agency as just an estimate. Because, as you said, because of this law that was passed by the Iranian parliament, the IAEA has had restricted access. And what Mr. Gharibabadi is saying in his response is that the level of access that the agency currently has is only based on the comprehensive safeguards agreement that Iran has with the agency, and it doesn't go beyond that. So any access that the agency had to Iran when it came to verifying and monitoring Iran's implementation of the JCPOA, the nuclear agreement and the restrictions set under that, and any access that the agency has there had based on the voluntary transparency measures that Iran was implementing, including complementary access given under the additional protocol or other accesses and other information that Iran provided to the agency and based on other voluntary and transparency measures that it signed up to under the JCPOA have now been halted.
Campaigning for Iran's 13th presidential election is gaining momentum as the candidates appear on TV and radio to present their plans to the people. Our correspondent, Humen Obedi, has the latest.
The IRIB, the broadcasting organization of Iran, the red carpet treatment is being given to the candidates who want to contest in 13th presidential election. Several studios are hosting the seven runners who explain in detail their plans.
The economy under my administration will focus on domestic production and exports. Whatever creates obstacles on that path has to be removed, and whatever strengthens that sector must be paid attention to and boosted. One of my administration's approaches will be to use a strong foreign policy to create international markets to improve our domestic production and exports. We can make the best of the demands in countries in South America, Africa, and South Asia to achieve that end.
Zakani stressed that the next administration has to change course and rely on Iran's domestic capabilities and utilize all regional and international capacities to move towards success. The other candidate, Saeed Jalili, said Iran must not await favors from those who murdered Iranian anti-terror commander Qasem Soleimani. He also added that a wrong approach and a weak performance cannot take the country to the summits. Mohsen Rezaei also took the floor to talk to the people regarding his economic agenda.
Some people misunderstood my plans about boosting the national currency. I said we can increase the value of our currency to become the third strongest money in the region after the US dollar and euro. It means that when you go to the exchange market after the first two, Iran's rial would be exchanged the most.
Rezaei also called for reforms in Iran's insurance, banking, and stock market systems. Reformist Mohsen Mehralizadeh, who was speaking at a news network, said that the main problems of the country today are due to macro policies, and the world-known scientific models should be used to solve the problems. In the end, Mehralizadeh referred to economic problems of people, but asked them to go to the polls to use the right of democracy to solve such issues. Some 60 million Iranians are eligible to vote in the 13th presidential election, which is slated to be held on June 18th. Uman Abedi, Tehran.
Moving on, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seems to be out of tricks to prolong his political career. The possibility has gained momentum after his arch-foe Naftali Bennett sought to squeeze him out of premier seat by working with the opposition leaders to build an alternative cabinet. Mona Candia has more in this report.
Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year reign as Israel's prime minister is much likely to end on Sunday. Naftali Bennett, a far-right politician leading Yamina party, and Yair Lapid, a centrist and opposition leader of Yesh Atid party, moved closer to forming a coalition after four inconclusive parliamentary elections in 2 years, and Netanyahu's repeated failure to form a coalition. Netanyahu accused Bennett of trying to form a leftist ruling structure that would ensure his rise to premiership. He said that Bennett had been sowing discord, division, and hatred against him.
There are many reasons behind efforts by the Israeli parties working together to oust Netanyahu. He has always declared himself as the only leader of Israel. He has no rival even within his own party. Meanwhile, he has failed to form a coalition so far. Therefore, removing him from the political scene could serve as a strong blow on the Likud and Netanyahu himself.
Bennett said his party would work with the opposition leaders to build an alternative cabinet. Observers say the alliance between eight relatively small parties with a diffuse range of ideologies won't be easy. But if they succeed, they had agreed that the prime minister's post would rotate between Bennett, a former settler leader who rejects the concept of a sovereign Palestinian state and champions the religious right, and Lapid, who is considered a voice of secular centrists.
It's not an easy mission. We are speaking about the ideological differences between two opposition parties. It's a complex decision for Bennett. They have to tackle lots of problems before forming the cabinet. Moreover, Netanyahu won't remain silent. He may take people with right-wing tendency to the streets to hamper efforts by any future cabinet.
Netanyahu has been holding onto power for the past 12 years. His popularity has, however, suffered an unprecedented plunge among the Israelis, who have been holding regular rallies outside his residence for months on end to force him to resign. Today, experts say nothing must be taken for granted because what's being described as the anti-Netanyahu cabinet of change is still not an accomplished fact. They say Netanyahu is not simply departing the scene without a fight for remaining in office. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Dozens of senior figures have condemned efforts to obstruct an investigation by the International Criminal Court into Israeli war crimes against Palestinians. In an open letter, more than 50 European ex-officials decried and called for an end to political interference in the ICC's inquiry. In the letter, they said attempts to discredit the court and block its work cannot be tolerated. The top figures expressed concern over, quote, unwarranted public criticism of the ICC's probe into Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. They also lashed out at former U.S. President Donald Trump for imposing sanctions against ICC staff members and their families, a move later reversed by Trump's successor, Joe Biden. The letter is also seen as a rebuke to British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who last month criticized the ICC for investigating Israeli crimes. Indigenous groups in Canada are demanding a nationwide search for mass graves at former residential school sites. The groups said the government should also help research undocumented deaths and burial at the sites. Last week, a mass grave containing remains of 215 children was found at a former residential school in the state of British Columbia. The bodies belonged to students, some as young as three. Canada forcibly sent more than 150,000 Indigenous children to residential schools between 1831 and 1996. A 2015 investigation documented abuse, malnutrition, and rape at the schools. The probe called the system a cultural genocide for forcing kids to abandon their native language and convert to Christianity. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has called the system a shameful reality of his country. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says the 2015 probe was quite right to call the assimilation system for Indigenous kids in Canada a cultural genocide.
There are reports that maybe as much as 25% of the kids that were brought into the residential school system actually died. So there is unfortunately probably many more burial sites on residential schools that exist in Canada, and maybe even burial sites that aren't on residential schools. But you know, the practice was in prisons and places like these residential schools that they would bury, you know, children or people often in unmarked graves on the site. Actually, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission documented 3,100 missing children. There's been 900 more identified. And there are probably even thousands more when you look around the country and looking at the schools in Western Canada, Northern Ontario, and Northern Quebec, where there still is a large Indigenous population. But we attempted to assimilate them basically out of existence, and that's correct to term that as a form of cultural genocide. The federal Liberal government has promised to investigate the sites and put forward the money for this ground-penetrating radar so they can identify a lot of these children, hopefully bring closure to the families. But we destroyed the social and cultural basis for a lot of the natives, and we substituted, you know, alcohol, drugs, social welfare, and, you know, sniffing gasoline.
Colombian demonstrators have once again clashed with security forces as the country undergoes its second month of anti-government protests. Police fired tear gas at protesters in Facatativá, a municipality near the capital, Bogotá. Clashes erupted while protesters were attending the funeral of an indigenous man who was reportedly killed during a previous demonstration. Anger is growing against the social and economic policies of the government of President Ivan Duque. The demonstrations began in April over a proposed tax increase. The government later withdrew the plan, but the protests grew wider against police violence, poverty, and health crisis. Dozens of people have been killed since then. The United Nations has called for an independent probe into the deadly unrest in the South American country. Peru has almost tripled its official coronavirus death toll, raising the number of fatalities from nearly 70,000 to more than 180,000. Following the revision, Peru now has the worst death rate per capita in the world. The sudden revision to the death toll comes while confirmed cases of the virus in Peru are inching closer to 2 million by the day. Meanwhile, Colombia turned into the world's third country in terms of new deaths, followed by Brazil. This as Brazil remains the world's second worst hit country in terms of deaths. On Monday, Brazilian officials registered over 30,000 new cases and 860 deaths from the virus. The latest figures have pushed the country's total fatalities to more than 462,000 out of more than 16.5 million confirmed cases. And a global climate summit is underway in South Korea with leaders and ministers from 60 countries participating in the virtual event. But South Korea's hosting of the forum has come under criticism from environmentalists who rallied and marched to the venue on Sunday, attacking the government's spotty record on carbon neutrality. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
South Korea is hosting the P4G Seoul Summit on Climate Change, bringing together leaders from more than 60 countries. Held both offline and online, the meeting sought, quote, inclusive green recovery toward carbon neutrality. South Korean President Moon Jae-in pledged more international aid.
We will provide more assistance to developing countries to lay tailored green growth policies. Countries have their own stages of economic development and thus they also differ on the dependence on coal power. Certainly more assistance is needed to transition into a low carbon economy.
Outside, critics point out that South Korea continues constructing and exporting coal-fired power plants, which generate the most CO2 emissions of all fossil fuels globally, about 30%. South Korea's pledge to end coal power financing. Climate change scientists agree that the COVID-19 pandemic and its lockdowns reduced human activity, which caused a reduction in CO2 emissions. But that reduction in climate-changing pollution will be short-lived. As people drive back to work, factories reopen, and airlines resume their pre-pandemic flight schedules. As the forum took place, environmental activists marched to the venue, critical of the government's carbon record and a new green growth plan to cut down old-growth forest to replant young carbon-absorbing trees.
The P4G summit talks about solidarity for green growth, but the climate crisis talks that count on growth are wrong from the start. The current climate crisis is the result of infinite growth for the nation in capital, for power and greed. Even if you put green in front of growth, that's just whitewashing the truth.
P4G, Partnering for Green Growth and Global Goals, links with the UN's 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, which focus on 17 international crises. Urgent action on climate change is number 13. Frank Smith, Seoul.
That's your board news for now.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
European Union tourists coming to the United Kingdom have told of being fingerprinted, detained, and treated like liars by border officials before trying to travel through the Channel Tunnel or by ferry at Calais. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Lisa O'Carroll and Giles Tremlett. The piece is titled, EU Tourists Complain of Fingerprinting at UK Border. European Union tourists coming to the United Kingdom have told of being fingerprinted, detained, and treated like liars by border officials before trying to travel through the Channel Tunnel or by ferry at Calais. Sergio D'Alberti, a 51-year-old Italian hotel manager currently out of work due to the COVID pandemic, told The Guardian he was held for 7 hours at the French port of Calais after UK Border Force officials concluded it would be a potential drain on the benefits system. They said his €4,500 in funds was not sufficient to cover all reasonable costs in relation to your being without working or accessing public funds, and that his lack of return ticket and job added to suspicion that he was lying. Sergio D'Alberti planned a road trip from his home in Côte d'Azur in southern France as a pleasant diversion during the pandemic on his way to Ireland to meet his wife's family in County Kerry. Instead, he said, he was held for hours, fingerprinted and photographed, like I was a criminal. As he had not booked every hotel for his trip after quarantine and he did not have a return ticket. It was a horrible experience. I'm disgusted the way I've been treated. I've never been so humiliated in my life. I will never ever go to the United Kingdom again. To me, the United Kingdom no longer exists. It is not in my vocabulary. After Calais, it is the North Pole, he said. His ordeal in Calais was matched by the experience of Chloe, a Danish pastry chef who had made a 10-hour trip from Jutland in Denmark with her boyfriend. I just went with him to visit his family. I have a job here in Denmark and was planning to stay for 3 weeks. Like D'Alberti, Chloe was turned away 2 weeks ago, but decided to return home because Border Force agents at Calais in northern France had told her that if she turned around voluntarily, then her encounter with them would not be registered. They issued her with an IS-81 stamp on her passport, indicating a person had made an application to enter, but no decision on that could be made because they had subsequently withdrawn it. When she made another attempt to enter the United Kingdom, arriving at Heathrow Airport on Sunday night, she discovered the full impact of the IS-81, which flagged her previous attempt, and she spent the next 5 hours crying in a Heathrow Airport detention room. Despite her return ticket for 16th of June and insistence that she was exercising her right as a European Union citizen to visit the United Kingdom without a visa, she feared Border Force officials planned to expel her and prevent her from seeing her boyfriend. Chloe was allowed out of Heathrow Airport at 10:30 p.m. after what she described as a horrific experience. Border Force officials could not explain why it took them so long or why she had been deprived of her freedom. They had also searched her bags and questioned her about her job in Denmark and also put questions to her about her parents. Chloe said she felt Border Force tried to push her into saying that she was coming to live permanently and illegally in Britain. She asked me why I was entering the United Kingdom and I said to visit my boyfriend, she said. She immediately said, live with your boyfriend, so I repeated, visit. Already she was putting words into my mouth. Sergio D'Alberti, who's starting a new job in Bayonne in France in July, claimed his unemployment status was twisted into a sinister motive for travel by officials and that his open-ended plans were treated with deep suspicion. They fingerprinted me. I asked them, is this normal to fingerprint visitors to Britain? Do you do this to everyone at the border? They fingerprinted every finger. Then they took a picture of my face like I was a suspect. A spokesperson for the Home Office said, we expect Border Force to treat all arrivals with respect and consider each passenger's situation on an individual basis. The British public expect us to check that everyone entering the United Kingdom has the right to do so, and passengers may be asked questions to establish the basis on which they're seeking to enter the United Kingdom. Under Immigration Rules, Appendix 5, the onus is on the tourist to satisfy the decision maker they are a genuine visitor. This means the applicant must satisfy officials that they will leave the United Kingdom after their visit. They will not live in the UK or make the UK their home. They are genuinely seeking entry for a permitted purpose, and must have sufficient funds to cover everything in their trip, including return journey and any costs incurred, including that of any planned private medical treatments.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
To swim in the murky waters of the North Sea, where lie the remnants of 5 centuries of naval battles. I found this submerged world even more fascinating as it was hidden. Through diving, I understood the extent of the military debris left behind by the 20th century. Because in the North Sea and the Baltic Sea, the Allies deliberately sunk ships transporting hundreds of millions of tons of chemical weapons. Today, we are holding more and more commemorations for both world wars, while under the sea, the metallic fuselages holding these substances are corroding. If we don't take action, scientists predict an unprecedented catastrophe.
The munitions are silent killers that are basically the chemical releases from them are drifting in the ocean as we speak today.
Why were these chemical weapons dumped in the sea? What action can we take to protect man and the environment before it's too late? Because this dreadful legacy is ready to resurface as if the salt water was preventing history's scars to heal.
Part 2.
at the start of the 20th century. The North Sea is the confrontation site for the industrial nations. France, the Netherlands, the UK, Belgium, and Germany battle over commercial and political geoeconomics. Europe's first industrial war sees the development of new weapons, like the submarine, the airplane, tanks, and deadly chemical weapons.
The dump site has been there for a long time. It has been there since 1919, when chemical munitions that were found in Belgium after the end of the First World War, it was mainly German munition. A lot of accidents happened, explosions, so they wanted to get rid of this dangerous munition. And they chose to dump it very close to the shore, so they could use small boats. They would not have to go very far, but because it was quite dangerous to transport a lot of chemical munition over a long distance.
...35,000 tons of chemical weapons, the equivalent of more than 1,000 of our current lorries. A few hundred meters away from the industrial port of Zeebrugge and Naka Beach. In addition to the danger of this proximity, the depth of the site is extremely weak, with some of the depot zones less than 1 meter away. Today, the currents have covered the bombs in a layer of sand and sea sediment. Is it the opacity of the North Sea or the hazards of turbulent history that have made the site disappear from memories? All North Sea and Baltic coasts are affected, and new sites appear. In the North Sea, over 50 sites are identified. This figure doesn't include many forgotten cases of dumping, so it's impossible to make a precise list of all the dumping sites.
I cannot imagine that France does not have any dump sites, be it for conventional munition or chemical munition. There must be, but we know absolutely nothing about it.
Not only was everyone expecting World War II to be a chemical war, but from 1934 onwards, the Nazis discover a new family, neurotoxins. They are 10,000 times more effective than the gases used in World War I. The chemical weapons race begins again in between wars. In preparation for the bombing of the Russian army, the Luftwaffe equips itself with these weapons that only the Germans possess. And yet these chemical strikes will never see the light of day, despite the help of Nazi dignitaries who dream of destroying the Red Army after the Stalingrad defeat. In order to help the fishermen, the Royal Danish Navy mission is to decontaminate ships polluted by gas. A bomb disposal unit is permanently ready to intervene in the zone.
Because of they have been in the water for so many years, the metal around the bombs is completely gone. And perhaps there will be some who have been laying down in the mud or the seabed, but nowadays it's come up, and if normally we find the bomb holes is about 50 kilos of mustard gas, and inside there is an opening explosive device about 3.7 kilos. It corroded slowly but surely. Here in Denmark, the government have decided if the fishermen have got the mustard gas or sneeze gas on board, we will compensate for the fish they have caught. We are the only country here in the EC who's doing that.
This allowed the Navy to gather statistics on the quantity of chemical weapons hauled up by fishermen. This information is not really representative because ocean interventions are far from being systematic. In fact, sailors often prefer to throw shells back into the sea to avoid any immobilization of their ships. The data gathered by Denmark is limited to one Danish sailor and doesn't count bombs recovered by German, Polish, Russian, and Norwegian trawlers that also sail through Bornholm waters. If combat gas harms sailors, we can also question the health of fish caught from the Baltic Sea.
On our ChemSea program, the search and assessment of chemical weapons, we investigated the codfish in munition sites and outside munition sites. In the munition sites, we actually found tumors in the codfish, stress on their kidneys and livers, extrapredential fish diseases. But the most alarming thing we found were the juvenile fish, their inability to reproduce. We're actually investigating Bellhorn now. We're taking fish samples, and some of these samples we have found are positive.
Whether the fish are contaminated is the question posed by the Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research. Scientists from the Institute analyzed the Bornholm dumping site and took part in the studies on the introduction of toxic agents to the food pyramid and the environment. After observing the cod population, they are interested in the impact of arsenic, a mustard gas component, on blue mussels, fish from the Baltic, and consumed throughout the whole of Europe.
So if you expose the mussels to these compounds, they take it up, and they take it up in relation to the concentration you expose them to, and they show even on the lower concentration, on the lowest concentration, they show already effects. There's one thing now to investigate how many or how high the concentration of a compound deriving from a warfare agent is in the organism you intend to consume, for example, so in the flesh of the fish or in the entire muscles. That's one thing, and you can debate about any limits now, which are allowed and which are maybe not really harming the consumer or not. However, there is, for me personally, there's only a general question. Do we accept that there are traces of damned ammunitions made to kill humans in your food?
What we know from the sediments and the water is that in all areas where munitions was dumped, you can find the substances leaking from the corroding munitions in the sediment and also in the deep waters. So there is a risk, really, that marine life takes up the substances in their natural habitat. After having studied this issue now for many years, we consider this to be a real ecological time bomb.
The issue of chemical weapons adds to the effects of global warming and industrial fishing. Scientific studies are on the increase. According to the Moscow Oceanographic Institute, if just a sixth of these substances escape into the Baltic, all forms of life would be wiped out for a century. If nothing is done, the ocean will probably be populated by just jellyfish. I'm struck by the contrast of the invisible dangers threatening the underwater world and the serene beauty of the surface. The sand dunes along the Danish coastline lead to the Skagerrak Strait, where the Baltic Sea waters mix with those of the North Sea. This is where the biggest officially listed site of the North Sea is found. Between 1946 and 1948, the Americans and British disposed of the Nazi chemical arsenal found in the occupation zone by sending a full fleet of military ships, their hulls full of toxic products, during an operation called Davy Jones's Locker.
In Operations Davy Jones, they dumped 296,000 tons of chemical weapons off the coast of Denmark. Apparently, there were supposed to be 7 shipwrecks full of munitions. We have started surveying and looking for the munition ships off of Denmark, and we're now past 20 shipwrecks full of munitions. So what we're finding all over the world is where they say there's a ton of munitions, we're finding hundreds of tons. Where they say there's a ship, we're finding dozens of ships full of munitions.
Indeed, in France, there was no formal information before the site was discovered accidentally. While searching for nuclear waste dumped in the channel by the Belgians and English, off the coast of Cherbourg, Greenpeace discovered even older chemical weapons. When an underwater site has the right attributes for discrete waste dumping, it's not unusual to see several historic levels of our wars there. The biggest threat is no longer military, but environmental. I wonder why the French army continues to keep a defense secret of the submersion in its territorial waters. Once rid of the stock from both world wars, the chemical ammunition found on battlefields was also submerged until the 1973 London Convention puts an end to this practice. Clearly, French took no notice because ammunition continued to be discreetly thrown overboard until 1997, the date when a National Navy ship had one of the most serious accidents. During a submersion operation off the Cherbourg coast, an explosion caused 5 deaths and 17 people were injured. The law recognized that the blame lay with the state and ordered €1 million in compensation for the families. A drop in the ocean compared to the investment required for an alternative to submersion.
This is no different than ocean dumping, but now you're just spreading it across the beach, and eventually the tide will come in and take that stuff back into the water again. All the countries of the world started doing open detonation and open burning, just another way of not paying the money to get proper disposal systems in.
In 2001, when Senate President Gerhard Larcher questioned Michel Sapin, Director of Defense and Civil Security, at a hearing that wasn't filmed, Sapin ironically said, "Apart from a few complaints from fish, detonation in the sea has never been a problem," unquote.
What do we do? You need to pick the munitions up, and you need to environmentally friendly dispose of them. They need to be gone.
The Convention Forbidding Chemical Weapons, signed by France in 1993, states that countries are responsible for ammunition on their territory. How do you explain that Germany and Belgium, with poor military budgets, have been working on solutions since 1980, while France is doing nothing? Domestic defense has the vast sum of 34.2 billion euros at its disposal, the equivalent of the Russian army, the second military force on the planet.
Virologists have infected millions of miniature organs with SARS-CoV-2 to learn how the virus wreaks havoc and how to stop it. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Smriti Malapati, researcher. This article is published under the heading Mini Lungs and Other Organoids Helping to Beat COVID. Stay tuned for more. Xuebing Chen spent close to 2 months tending to her mini lungs, some half a million of them. Each one looked like a tiny storm cloud, ensconced in a warm dish and protected by a jelly-like dome. Chen, a stem cell biologist at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City, and her team had nurtured them from clumps of human cells, adding nutrients every few days as they grew into 3D air sacs. These lung organoids matured until they reached the size of a lentil. Then the team packed them up and transported them just a few blocks away to a lab authorized to work with SARS-CoV-2, the virus responsible for COVID-19 pandemic. There, the organoids were drowned in virus and each was doused with one of the 15,000 drugs. Almost all of the mini lungs died, but a few of the drugs stemmed the infection, representing a handful of possible treatments for COVID-19. Chen is one of the many cell biologists who have been driven by the pandemic to push the boundaries of organoid technology for studying infectious diseases. In the past year, researchers have created mini lungs, guts, livers, brains, and more to study how SARS-CoV-2 infects organs. They have learned which cells the virus targets, the speed of that attack, and how the cells retaliate. Organoids have found their way into the toolbox of virologists, says Hans Clevers, a developmental biologist at Hoprecht Institute in Utrecht, the Netherlands. The technology had previously been used mainly to study basic human biology, development, and related disorders and cancers, with only a few labs using the models to study viruses and other infectious diseases. But the pandemic has brought organoids to center stage, sparing high-impact papers and demonstrating their value for drug development, says Clevers. They are a welcome addition because current methods of studying viruses have several limitations. The typical workhorse of virology is a cancer cell line from the kidney of an African green monkey, first extracted almost 60 years ago and dividing ever since. These cells, known as viral cells, are excellent for growing viruses, but don't reflect the human body's normal antiviral response. They are really screwed up, says Elk Molberger, a virologist at Boston University, Massachusetts. Researchers also use some cancerous human cell lines, but similar to the viral cells, they don't respond to infections in the way that normal cells would. Although researchers have now established the potential relevance of organoids for studying new antiviral drugs, their work has not yet led to marketable treatments. Organoids technology has benefited more from the pandemic than the treatment of COVID-19 has benefited from organoids yet, says Clevers. To realize the technology's full potential, scientists still need to find ways of growing more complex systems, for example, by adding immune cells and blood vessels. Researchers also need to streamline the production process to create thousands, if not millions, of uniform organoids quickly and cheaply. The use of organoids to study viruses is only at its infancy, says Ji Zhu, a virologist at the University of Hong Kong. Before she started working with organoids, virologist Mary Est relied on a much messier way to study the highly contagious vomiting bug norovirus. Nobody could grow the virus in the lab, so instead she would isolate it from the excrement of people who willingly ingested it and suffered the consequences for the sake of her research. In 2011, she saw a paper by Clevers in which he grew mini guts from stem cells scraped off the villi, the tiny tentacles that line people's intestines. Clevers had created the first organoids derived from adult stem cells, which grow almost indefinitely under the right conditions and can build themselves into complex structures that reflect their organ of origin. Organoids had already been made from embryonic stem cells or induced pluripotent stem, that is iPS cells, which can develop into any cell type, but they typically reflect organs early in fetal development. I thought, well, that looks like a system we ought to try, says S, who is at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. Nobody else was using those cultures for virology at the time. In 2016, almost half a century after its identification, S became the first person to grow human norovirus in a dish in a way that could be reproduced in an intestinal organoid. Her studies prove that organoids were a good model of disease in people. She discovered, for instance, that norovirus variants did not replicate at all in organoids made from the cells of people who typically don't get sick from the virus. Researchers have since used organoids to study many more viruses, including respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, a common cause of lung infection in children, in airway organoids, and the rare and mysterious BK virus in kidney organoids. In 2016, a team infected developing brain organoids with Zika virus and established a link between the infection in pregnant women and microcephaly, a condition in which a fetus has an atypically small head. 10 days after being infected, the brain organoids were 40% smaller than the uninfected organoids. These neural progenitor cells are fertile soil for Zika infection, says Patricia Garces, a neurobiologist at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, who led the work. And on March 15, 2020, the day the Netherlands went into lockdown, researchers requested samples of SARS-CoV-2 from colleagues in Rotterdam. Within 7 weeks, researchers published a paper in Science showing that SARS-CoV-2 readily replicated in mini guts, especially targeting cells called anthracites that line the intestines. The study helped to explain why some people with COVID-19 have digestive problems, including diarrhea and vomiting, and identified another possible route of transmission. Researchers have since shown that SARS-CoV-2 can infect a host of mini organs, from the liver to kidneys to the brain, mimicking the multi-organ damage seen in some people with COVID-19.